The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the American College of Osteopathic Internists Annual Convention and Scientific Sessions. This year's meeting was held in conjunction with the Annual Clinical Assembly of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons. The meeting was held October 11th through 15th, 2017, and featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of interest to the practicing physician. The meeting was held at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. The program chair is Dr. Annette Caron, and the theme for this year's presentations is Goldilocks Medicine, Not Too Little, Not Too Much. Practices and Pitfalls in Reflux Surgery is presented by Dr. J.P. Smith.
Good morning. Very nice to be able to speak to all of you today concerning the topics of reflux surgery. I do need to let you know that I have no disclosures other than the fact that I serve as a proctor for robotic surgery for the Da Vinci Company. But the learning objectives of what I hope to accomplish today in putting this in perspective after hearing Dr. Hoffman's speech about reflux disease in general is that there's no question that acid reflux disease exists. As surgeons, we see a little bit different spectrum. And in Jerome Strike's book, How Doctors Think, he made the statement, where you stand depends on where you sit. And that has a great deal to do with how we approach reflux disease as surgeons as opposed to internists. Very rarely do I see patients that have not already been on H2 blockers and already been on PPIs and already failed before they come in to see me as a surgeon. So we're looking at a different spectrum of the population as opposed to a primary care physician or even a gastroenterologist from that standpoint. But we're going to talk about some of the differences in the operative techniques that are available for the treatment of reflux disease. We're going to talk a little bit about the esophagomyotomy for achalasia, and we're also going to talk a little bit about periosteal hernias because each of those has a different impact. And then I'll talk just briefly about some of the future developments that are on the horizon for us in surgery. The reflux indications are much the same as Dr. Hoffman had talked about. However, the number one that I see in my office is the failed patient, the one who has had medical therapy and maybe has not had any type of a diagnostic workup other than simply has been on PPI as a trial of therapy. There is a wide spectrum of treatment for gastroesophageal reflux in the primary care offices, and so the ones that we see are quite different. My second bullet that you see on the list is much like Dr. Hoffman's as well, non-compliance. It's amazing how many people have a prescription for a PPI or an H2 blocker that have no concept at all about how frequently they should take it, or the concept that I don't really need to take it, but maybe every third day or every fourth day or when I have heartburn. And so we spend a fair amount of time in the office explaining the rationale for treatments and physiologically how it works in order to get a better improvement. High volume reflux and regurgitation is different than garden variety acid indigestion. And so frequently we have difficulties in communication with our patients because they all come in with preconceived notions as what reflux really is. So we have to make sure that we're talking about the same disease and the same processes in order to make sure we get the results that we'd like. There doesn't seem to be a great deal of controversy as we go farther down the list for the strictures, the Barrett's esophagus without dysphagia, but we also find those non-GI diseases that creep up in my office as well with the chronic coughs, the adult onset asthma from my pulmonary referral doctors as well. The interesting thing about the reflux surgery is that it has not changed since 1954 when Roland Nissen first developed a procedure whereby he would go in and narrow the esophageal hiatus, pulling the stomach back down into the abdominal cavity, creating a lengthened intra-abdominal portion of the esophagus, and then creating a 360-degree floppy wrap. That basically is the same technique that's been done since before my days in surgery. But we found that during my surgical training, we did very few of these operations because the operation was worse than the disease itself. And so we were very, very selective. And I'm not sure that I did more than three or four during my entire surgical residency. That same thing continued during the first portion of my practice, as it was an extreme case for anybody to be considered for esophageal reflux type surgery. But very gradually, something changed over time. We initially looked at open laparotomy, and I'd seen one case of an open thoracotomy to do a repair. That was felt to be the indication for reflux disease in patients that had previously had intra-abdominal right upper quadrant surgeries and left upper quadrant. So consequently, we'd have some chest approaches. But then in the early 1990s, the advent of laparoscopy kind of changed our thoughts about Nissen's and fundoplications. We began doing the laparoscopic gallbladder surgeries, and very shortly, docs began to stretch the horizon for laparoscopic surgery, applying it not only to gallbladder surgery, but to Nissen's. Our early days were fraught with problems because of the inability to control the bleeding, and very frequently those laparoscopic Nissen's ended up being 4 to 6 hour operations that were converted to open. We developed technology that then allowed us to control bleeding much more effectively with harmonic scalpels. That changed the approach to a great degree, and the operation became somewhat easier. Then in the middle 2010 area to 2013, robotic surgery began to be in the armamentarium of the general surgeon after having been used by both the urologist and the gynecologist for almost 10 years before we in general surgery took that up. It changed the operation in that it made the operation shorter and one that could be done as an outpatient with fairly reliable results in the hands of most general surgeons. Anyone that could master the skills of robotic surgery could apply them almost directly using the technology. The operation, however, did not change at all. The tenets of the surgery were exactly the same as we outlined beforehand, with skeletonization of the esophagus, pulling it down into the abdomen. The port placement became an issue. We've seen now a generational change in robotic surgery from the SI to the XI, and the port placement has changed to some degree as well. We find that placing the ports in more of an arc instead of a diamond has changed how we approach that and made the access even easier. The other thing that robotic surgery has done in reflux surgery is it's taken an operation that, while it was great for the patient, it was horrible for the surgeon. Ergonomically, it was a tough, tough operation, and 3 to 4 hours of leaning across an abdomen with your arms extended caused some significant problems ergonomically for the surgeon. It was a difficult operation, but one that we did because it was good for the patients. Robotically has taken that now to a different level where sitting at a console, one can perform the operation with minimal ergonomic stresses. There are a couple of things that the tools that have changed a little bit over time. The graspers that now have the articulation with robotics has made a huge difference. And instead of operating with straight sticks, which were certainly possible, we now have our wrists and our elbows back so that we can now articulate the instruments to be able to grab and move them where we want. They've developed what's referred to as the diamond flex retractors that can be inserted into the abdominal cavity and created into a shape that can be used to retract the liver out of the way. So visualization is absolutely incredible for doing robotic surgery in the left upper quadrant. The hallmark of the operation when done open was that it was done 99% of the time blind. After making an abdominal incision, with feel, we could go in and feel the vagus nerves, we could feel the esophageal hiatus, and we simply stripped those things out because it was almost impossible to see, or if you could see, only one person could see at a time. Robotically, now that's changed to the point where the dissection is very precise. We can lose almost 5 to 10 cc's of blood during most operations and be able to see the cura well enough to be able to place our sutures appropriately and do the operation in a less traumatic fashion. The retractor on the left side of the screen is a diamond flex retractor that my assistant uses that's shaped like a hook that can be used to place under the esophagus to gently elevate the esophagus, getting it out of the field of view so that we can see much more easily. This makes a whole lot of difference as far as when we're trying to figure out how to get the best visualization in the upper quadrant. Most physicians use a Penrose drain. You can see the diamond flex has that small curve and it comes in both directions, right or left. So placement of it is one of those tips that I found makes a whole lot of difference in doing that. Some surgeons prefer to place a Penrose drain around the esophagus and use that with their assistant elevating at the same time. Both work remarkably well and just give us an incredible vision into the esophageal hiatus. We can then dissect up into the mediastinum, almost to the level of the azotic vein if necessary, in order to mobilize the esophagus to make sure we've pulled it back down into the intra-abdominal cavity to create that barrier. The next slide shows some of the differences in the techniques of how we do that. We've seen quite a bit of difference over the years in the different techniques. And in the literature, there is quite a bit of difficulty in trying to come up with, is there one operation that's actually the best operation? And the answer is probably no. We probably need to use an armamentarium of different techniques in order to accomplish our fundoplication. The Hill technique was a very simple one that just simply transfixed the esophageal hiatus and then placed a placating suture in order to recreate the angle of His. This helped to create that anti-reflux valve. The door resection simply brings an anterior wrap over the top of the esophagus, and this door fundoplication is what we most commonly use with the Heller esophageal myotomy in order to protect our opening of that myotomy. The toupee fundoplication, there was a great deal of literature that initially came out saying that if you have someone based on their motility study to have very poor esophageal motility, that doing a partial wrap or the toupee procedure actually gave you better outcomes. There have since been techniques that have come out saying that maybe that doesn't make much difference one way or the other, although it still, from a logistical standpoint, makes sense if you have difficulty passing through the esophagus. Some of the subsequent studies that came out said the Nissen fundoplication probably works for those patients as well because the lower esophageal motility decrease may have actually been due to the esophageal reflux. And once you correct the reflux, they may have normal motility. In my practice, I find that use of pH and motility studies is almost mandatory for every person considering an operative intervention. I certainly don't do pH studies on every patient because when you've done your endoscopy and you see the evidence of esophageal erosions and inflammation, it makes no reason to continue with a pH study. But the motility study does still give me additional information. There is nothing worse than doing one of these operations on someone who doesn't need the operation. Then your complications become devastating. And so with the patient who has achalasia, to do a simple Nissen wrap will create a nightmare for you, an albatross that you wear for a long time as you take care of those postoperative patients. The Nissen fundoplication, as depicted here, is quite simply a 360-degree wrap around the esophagus. That particular operation has well been tried and true and works very well. There is, however, marked differences from surgeon to surgeon, so you don't always find the results to be identical across the board. And you'll find that after you've reached that point of approximately 25 to 50 Nissens, you'll begin to get to that point where you actually have the feel for how tight is a floppy wrap. Initially, when I started doing the Nissen fundoplications, I used it over a bougie, using a 56 bougie. Having watched two of my best anesthesiologists pushed the bougie through the esophagus. I reached a point at which I felt pretty comfortable in not using bougie after repairing a couple of those holes in the distal esophagus. But that's something you can't get without being able to see how tight it is and then follow those patients postoperatively. But there's no question that it has to be without tension, and it has to be loose in order to be effective. You'll see in the literature a lot of talk about the callus gastroplasty and the higher failure rate of the Nissen fundoplication if you have a congenitally short esophagus. That is something that we're very cognizant of. However, I'll have to admit, in doing over 200 of the Nissen procedures, I found it necessary in only one case to do a callus gastroplasty. With the stapling devices that are now available with the robotic surgery, it's quite easy now to do a callus gastroplasty by first mobilizing the esophageal fundus, pulling down on it, and creating a triangular wedge up against the side of the esophagus to lengthen the intra-abdominal portion of the esophagus. This seems to work fairly well in being able to create that lengthened esophagus, which is critical and part of the operation. Each part of the operation has its own pitfalls and problems. If you don't have a long enough esophagus, your procedure will fail. If your Nissen wrap is too tight, your procedure will fail. If you are too aggressive in your dissection around the esophagus and you damage the vagus nerve, your procedure will be complicated and you'll have problems with diarrhea. There are a number of complications that can occur, but careful technique helps to obviate a great number of those complications. The Heller myotomy is an operation that I've done approximately 10 of those procedures. It's listed as being a condition which occurs in less than 1 in 100,000 people. However, in my town of 300,000, I've already done 10 cases, so it's hard for me to imagine that. But it can be documented very nicely with esophageal motility studies. When you see that motility study, or even from the occasional upper GI series, which showed the classic bird beak appearance of the distal esophagus, that is an individual that will respond very nicely and almost immediately from esophageal myotomy. I've used as a clinical trial in some of those patients a trial of Botox injections before I would result in surgery. Most of these people are fairly young. In the elderly patients, Botox injections may be enough to take care of that for long enough to get them by. It'll generally only last about 3 months, but it will tell you if that's exactly what your diagnosis is by the relaxation of the esophagus. They will still have poor motility even when you do an esophageal myotomy and you cut through the esophageal circular muscles down to the mucosa itself. You will not have the obstruction at the distal esophagus, but they still don't have motility. So those patients, if they eat and lay down immediately, will still have problems. So you have to warn them a little bit about expectations of the operative intervention itself as to what you can expect will occur after the operation. I found it to be necessary to combine some type of a fundoplication after the esophageal myotomy is done, because undoubtedly those people will end up in reflux afterwards when you make their esophageal junction patulous. Those people will then develop some symptoms of reflux, and using a door fundoplication with simply an anterior or 180 degree wrap seems to take care of most of those patients. It also serves as kind of a pants over vest approach to that denuded esophageal mucosa. It is very nerve-wracking to go back and do your endoscopy immediately after the surgery to look to see how thin that esophageal mucosa is, but it can be protective with that wall of the stomach laying over the top of it. That seems to work very nicely, and I've had minimal problems with that aspect with the esophageal myotomy. Hiatal hernia is different, and I find that there's a great deal of misinformation from a patient standpoint about what a hiatal hernia is and what its relationship to esophageal reflux. The two are not synonymous, and the two can be separate. I've had elderly patients in their 80s and 90s who came in with an intrathoracic stomach with a huge esophageal problem, however, no reflux whatsoever. And quite the converse, I've had people with no hiatal hernia and terrible esophagitis and reflux. So they're not synonymous and they're not treated exactly the same. The classification system that's put up on the slide for you shows those four types of hiatal hernias that exist. It's interesting and it's significant from a coding standpoint that category 2, 3, and 4 are all technically paraesophageal hernias. That may be splitting hairs as far as our diagnosis. A hiatal hernia is a hiatal hernia. But unfortunately, we live in a day and age where we have to split hairs with our coders in order to be able to do what we do. In looking at that, the procedure itself is very similar to the standard procedure for a Nissen fundoplication with a couple of differences and a couple of ticks that are very helpful. In those patients who present with a substantial hiatal hernia, type 2 to 4, they will almost all have some type of a peritoneal sac that extends up into the chest cavity. It is very important that that sac be dissected free. That seems to be a fairly reliable indicator of surgical failure if you don't take the sac down and just simply do a wrap. And I'm not sure whether it's the denuding or exactly what causes that, the physiology to prevent the reoccurrence, but it's much more likely to not reoccur if you do, in fact, take the hernial sac itself out. This technically is probably the most difficult part of the operation because under laparoscopic control or robotic control, you have intra-abdominal pressures of 12 to 14 millimeters of mercury, which basically fill that sac. And so it becomes a constant struggle of pulling and pushing and pulling and pushing, trying to get the sac down. But once you make that small incision up into the mediastinal area where the air actually gets up above the sac, the CO2 will cause minimal, if any, problems and will then allow you to pull the sac down to be able to resect it. Then the curl repair becomes very important. And whether you use a primary repair or one with a mesh material, most frequently, folks are now using biologic mesh, although we certainly use synthetic mesh early on. That becomes a determination of how you're going to complete your operation. If I can get by with one or two simple sutures with minimal tension, I won't place mesh on all my cases. Once again, you'll find a wide spectrum of specialists across the country from people that say, I use mesh on every hiatal hernia, to people that say, I don't use mesh on any hiatal hernia. And I think somewhere in between is a happy medium. For those very large intrathoracic type 4 hiatal hernias, I think it makes great sense to consider some type of a mesh that is going to dissolve and go away at the end of 6 months, because your first 6 months is your greatest period of time of failure from the esophageal surgery itself. The fundoplication, I think, becomes important, although I don't use that on every type 4. If they've had any inkling of symptoms of reflux disease prior to surgery, I will certainly do a fundoplication. And then the fixation of the stomach is something that I've also found helpful. We've had some early failures with the intrathoracic stomachs. And by placing a placating suture of the stomach wall to the interabdominal wall, that seems to minimize that reoccurrence as well. The reason it makes a difference is this slide, and the slides are on your app as well, so you can look at that. But I've included the CPT code and also placed out on the other end the RVUs. And you'll see that as it comes out, whether or not you use mesh is critical as far as the number of RVUs that the surgery itself is ascribed. And there's a lot of difference between the different techniques, whether it's esophageal myotomy or the plain hiatal hernia repair. So you can look at the RVUs and get some degree of information about the complexity of the procedures itself. And if you're going to do a more complex operation, you need to be remunerated for what you're doing. So this gives you a little bit better idea about how to approach the patient with the different forms of problems. I did want to take just a few minutes to talk a little bit about some of the new emerging techniques that may change how we approach this. The Stretta procedure for reflux has been around since the late 90s. I was an early adopter for Stretta, and then based on the fact that it was not reimbursed by any insurance companies and patients didn't want to pay for it, it fell kind of from favor. But now it seemed to be making a resurgence with some improved technology. It simply scars the lower esophagus in order to increase your esophageal closing pressures. It does work in some cases. It's not very effective in patients who have hiatal hernias also, in addition to the reflux. So once again, you're looking at choosing your tools carefully to try to make them fit what your patients actually have, rather than making one hammer work for the nail on everything. The POEM technique is really very fascinating for esophageal problems. The patients who have achalasia seem to do very well with this advanced technique for endoscopic resections, just available in certain limited institutions. But basically with the endoscope, they enter the lower esophagus, making a small incision, dissecting that small incision out up against the mucosa and advancing their scope down, and then with electrocautery cutting the esophageal muscle, leaving the mucosa intact, and then either clipping it or suturing it back together afterwards. Accomplishes exactly the same thing that we do robotically, and obviously is well tolerated in the hands of those who are doing a lot of those particular procedures. The Lynx reflux management system by Torex is also very intriguing in that it presents a system of magnets in a small line, similar to the little wristbands that the babies wear in the hospital, except they're magnetized. You can take and insert that intra-abdominally at the time of your surgery, and instead of doing a fundoplication, simply apply it around the lower esophageal sphincter, and then it will respond, and with minimal pressures as food boluses comes down through, open enough to allow the food to go through, and then close back to prevent the reflux. In my practice, I've found several things that have been extremely helpful in making my success rate higher. And part of that has to do with choosing my patients more effectively. Without the use of motility and pH and endoscopy in my practice, I would find it very difficult for me to get success rates that are sufficient to warrant the risks that are undertaken by having reflux surgery. There are patients that I can see in the office that I can almost predict will fail, and I inform them of that. Those patients who do not lose weight or are obese, the success rates after anti-reflux surgery are dismal, and it's simply not an easy answer. You would think in this day and age, most patients would not want to have an operation instead of lose weight, but as we find, there are more and more people that we have to deal with the super obese, and those patients, when you try to repair them, even though technically you can do it, and robotically it's an easy operation, the failure rate is much, much higher in those patients that have obesity to deal with. The second factor I find is cigarette smoking. That seems to make a huge difference. We all know that nicotine paralyzes the lower esophageal sphincter and causes and predisposes to reflux. Those patients are not going to do quite as well as the individuals that don't, so I get my patients to quit smoking or at least give them the lecture beforehand. And also they have to have failed. If you have someone that has been on PPIs and got no results at all, zero, zip, none, I'm very suspicious that those people are not going to get better with a Nissen fundoplication, because both things do the same thing. They prevent acid exposure in the lower esophagus. So it makes you re-question yourself as to why am I doing the operation if they didn't get any response at all with the PPI. So in summary, gastroesophageal reflux surgery and lower esophageal surgery is an emerging field that's continuing to change on a daily basis. It is one that can be done comfortably and easily with robotic surgery in this day and age with the technology that we have available to us, and is still an option that has to be considered in those patients that have failed medical therapy. Thank you very much.